Music from Buddy Miller, This Old World. We heard from Chris Rice, his song Good News. We heard from First Call, Timothy's Burden, and Margaret Becker. That was her with How Can I Keep From Singing. 16 minutes after the hour on a Broken Road Radio Friday morning. I'm Jim Park and Dave Allen Punch in the newsroom, and joining us now from, I presume, Minneapolis, isn't it, Jeff? In Minneapolis?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Jeff, yeah. Jeff Hertzberg, who is a doctor and an author, and he's an advertising and PR executive now. Just about you've been flying all over the country talking about your books and probably a number of book signings too. You spend some time in bookstores.
We've done bookstores. When you don't have a TV show, sometimes you spend time in bookstores alone. But we had some very good turnout in Minneapolis and in Chicago and in Portland this year.
Portland, Oregon.
We had a lot of fun.
And Jeff is the author, actually the co-author of a book called Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. And there's also a new Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. And it's one of a series of books about making bread at home, but really not the old-fashioned way. And I'm beginning to think, Jeff, you're a revolutionary, and that MD that comes after your name may just well stand for Master of Dough, do you think?
I hope so. I'm going to start using that with your permission.
Yeah, you could certainly use that. You're a man that, well, you just think out of the bread box. You do.
I mean, it's been a long time of making the bread this way, and my wife and I had thought this was going to be an eccentric family project that I would do, and you'd open my refrigerator and dough would fall out.
People making fun of you around the kitchen, yeah.
People made fun of us, but then they ate it, and then they said, how'd you do that? And so all my friends knew how to do it, and it's very simple, but didn't think I was going to ever have a chance to have an alternative career like this going on in the background. And I'm very, very lucky.
This is pretty exciting, and I'm looking at your website now, and I know I could be clicking all over the website and learning a lot about bread, but frankly, there's this picture of a Christmas stolen up there, and I'm reluctant to click away from it. I'm just captivated by that. That is really beautiful.
That's one of my go-to demo recipes when I'm doing a bread class and somebody says, what's an easy dessert that's actually kind of healthy? The original version of this was in our second book, Healthy Bread in 5 Minutes a Day, mm-hmm. and it's made with whole wheat flour, which you can't see in there in that picture because it's white whole wheat, which is a new
agricultural product that's come out
in the last 10 years.
Interesting. I remember stolen so fondly from my German childhood. Born into a family of Germans, that used to be regular. It's been decades though since I've seen it. And Jeff, I have to ask you. Bread has been around a long time, and you're at the beginning of a revolution here. I think if we go back an eon or two, there was some guy in the Middle East that wandered out to a field one day and said, "Hey, wait a minute. I think we can grow this stuff. And if we shake it off at the end of the year, we cut it all down and we shake it off and we pound it with rocks, just think what we could do with it." And he turned to his wife and she said, "Yeah, but you'll need yeast, which we can't even see and don't even know about yet. You'll need to pound on it, wrestle with it, massage it and let it rise and do that." And he looked at her and he said, "Well, you could do that part." And it wasn't too long before he woke up and there were caramel rolls on the breakfast table. Now, this process took a long time, and bread has always been something. A baker needs to go to work at midnight, and he starts cranking out his stuff, and there's flour flying around, and there's ovens going, and by 6 or 7 in the morning, he has his inventory for the day, and that's a lot of work. And now you come along with a little bit of science and a little bit of research, and you turn all that on its ear. How do you justify this, Jeff?
Okay, here's what changed. So you're right. It's 5 or 10,000 years of societies being built on stored wheat kernels and grinding them up in this whole process. They knew about a natural process of fermentation, so they didn't have any idea what was going on, but yeast in the air and in the grains already set up a process of respiration, and they were using the carbohydrates in the wheat, and that produced carbon dioxide, which rose up the flour and water mixture that they had made.
It had to be an accident.
They could live on it.
Had to be an accident. Somebody looked at that loaf and said, "Oh, wait a minute, what happened? What is this?"
That's right.
Yeah.
It's definitely an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So 5,000 to 10,000 years, but in the last 140 years, there's an innovation that changed everything, and that's called the refrigerator.
Ah.
And because it used to be that you'd have natural, what we now call sourdough. They had natural sourdough as the only rising until probably 100 years ago. They didn't have commercial yeast. And what they found was that they'd get the stuff really sour. It would get over sour at some point. They have to throw some of it out and use a little bit of it as sort of a seed in a new batch of dough.
Mm-hmm.
What we know now is that if you slow that process down in a refrigerator, you can skip the replenishment. And that's sort of the simplification step. So what we did in our books is to make a large batch of dough that you can store in the refrigerator for up to 2 weeks. And because the refrigerator is cold and the yeast doesn't have time to overdo it and oversour and lose all of its rising ability, you can get away with it. Basically, you're sort of committing a cardinal sin. Bakers have known for many years that you could do what's called a retard phase, R-I-T-A-R-D, which is from the French, and you could get away with a day or two. And all we did was say, well, if you push it, if you get the dough to just the right amount of moisture, which we experiment with a lot, we could go up to 14 days. And what that means is you mix once and bake off many, many times. And you couldn't make such a big batch like that in the desert. After a day or so, it's just going to be over-bubbly and liquidy. And it sort of turns into slime at that temperature. So refrigerator changed everything. And the key difference between our books and any of the others that are out there is that you can bake it.
Oops, I think we're kind of losing you there, Jeff. We're gonna cut our video here a little bit so that we'll make it easier for the signal to get through. Go ahead.
Okay, how about now? How
are we doing? A little better. Yeah.
Okay, good. So most of our recipes store for up to 14 days. The enriched ones with eggs or butter or milk, we usually keep that at 5 because there's eggs and butter in it, so you don't want that around your refrigerator.
So 5 days.
Too long. Yeah, at least 5 days. So that changes everything. This dough is sitting in your fridge, and you can take it out anytime you want. You let it on the rise on the counter, let it rest. Really, it doesn't rise much at that point. Anywhere from 45 to 90 minutes. The longer rise will give you a more open crumb. And that changes everything, because essentially it's all in there. And I'll plug a local product. What is it really sort of modeled on, in a way, is popping fresh rolls that are sitting in the fridge, except these are homemade. So you can control and put whatever you want on it.
Well, is this something then that Pillsbury discovered years ago and put in little tubes? Is it essentially?
They're not yeasted. Those are quick breads. They're made with baking soda and baking flour. It's a different flavor, and it's not really bread at all. It's usually rolls.
Okay.
And they need to use a lot of preservatives in those to keep them fresh on the shelf.
Okay. Well, listen, I've got to tell you a story here, little history, personal history here, that leads me to think that you and I are kindred spirits, and then I want to hear your story. I grew up in the 50s in Duluth, Minnesota. My dad was a traveling salesman. He was out of town for a week or two at a time. Now, he evolved the tradition when he was coming home from a long trip that he would, on his way home, he would drive back to Duluth. He would stop at the European Bakery on First Street in Duluth and buy two or three or four loaves of their caraway rye bread. And it would be warm out of the oven. And he would drive the few minutes to home, and by the time he got there was about 1.5 loaves left. But we all got to enjoy some. It was magic stuff. Now, I moved back to Minnesota 30 years ago, and one of the first thoughts I had was, I wonder if that European bakery is still there. 30 years ago, it was. And I actually called them up, and I said, I remember your bread from the 1950s. This is the third generation operating this European bakery now. And I said, can you make some and mail it to me? Because I wasn't in Duluth. And they said, mail it? That's crazy. And I said, well, no, your bread, even after 2 or 3 days in the mail, is going to be better than anything I can find in a grocery store. And they did, and it was wonderful. But they have since gone out of business. And for the last several years, I've been striving to recreate that rye recipe myself. Your book, I think, has done it for me. You have some history with rye bread, too, from your New York days. Tell us about that.
It's so funny when you were telling it. It's the same story, except it was my grandfather. And my mom's parents would come to our house pretty much every Sunday morning. And we would have, a typical New York breakfast of bagels and rye bread and cream cheese and lox. We would do this pretty much every Sunday. It was a tradition that I grew up with. The bagels were good, but the rye bread was great. There was a place in the neighborhood that he would go, and he always had to have some, he was very choosy about which loaf they give him. He was always afraid they would give him one that was underbaked. He liked it really dark. He asked for the darkest one they had.
Well, that's a manly loaf. I call that a manly loaf when it's dark brown.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I don't think he used that terminology, but I think it was, and it was fantastic. And the place is still there, but these corner bakeries that had this fantastic stuff that was pretty much the same recipe from Europe, those disappeared sometime in the 80s in New York in the neighborhood.
That's sad.
They're still great. It is sad. There's still great breads in New York, but you got to go. You got to seek them out, and it's $7, $8, $9 a loaf. I remember it was like $1.23.
Yeah.
Now, granted, this is 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was obsessed with this bread. I could eat half a loaf of that stuff with butter or cheese, sort of between meals. My brother and I would just demolish these loaves, and two quarts of milk, of course.
Yeah.
And I moved to Minneapolis in 87, and most of this tradition had already died out. We thought we had made this great discovery in the United States of sliced bread, and I have an opposite, which is the worst thing ever invented was sliced bread.
I think so. And that was Wonder Bread back in the 30s that came out of sliced bread to begin with.
That's
and it's
right.
It's been downhill ever since. You'd think in a place like Minnesota with such a Scandinavian and German heritage here that there would be ethnic bakeries all over. But that's so to our loss. And I'm wondering if the techniques and the recipes. Now, you traveled Europe, didn't you, doing some research for this? Yeah, what did you learn over there?
Well, at least when I started traveling 25 years ago, the Europeans hadn't lost this yet, and every town we'd pull up to in the bicycle, you could basically find the bake shops that I didn't have anymore in New York, and certainly not in Minnesota. And they still had it, and it reminded me how much I loved this stuff, and I decided to try to learn to bake. And my wife had been a baker in college, and she taught me the traditional method, and I was a medical resident. It was completely unrealistic. So you're kneading. I wanted that bread every day. And it's completely unrealistic. I was working 12-hour days. I was sleeping in the hospital every third or fourth night. It was just ridiculous. And so I started leaving the dough in the refrigerator for longer and longer between, remix.
Mm-hmm.
And I found you could do that if you used wet dough. Wet but not too wet. And we could get into the science of what percentage worked. And it's in our books, but this isn't usually what people...
Yeah, the water is the key here, isn't it?
The water is the key. Because otherwise you have to knead the dough, and second of all, you can't store the dough if it's not wet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like a drier bread, this is the wrong one for you, but usually people will develop a taste for the sort of, external is really crusty, the inside is nice and moist, it actually stays fresh for longer than typical homemade bread because the moisture level is so high it doesn't dry out right away.
That's another interesting aspect I hadn't picked up, and I haven't had time to read through the book entirely yet because there's so much information in the book. And again, there are actually a series of books. The first book, it was the first one, wasn't it? Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes
bread
a Day.
Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day, right. And we just reissued that book this year. It's called The New Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. People are still buying the old one on Amazon. I don't think the old one is available in bookstores anymore. And when they run out of copies, They won't keep printing it. There's just going to be the new artisan bread. We upgraded the book with 30 new recipes. It's about 130 pages longer, and basically everything people asked for from our website, which is breadin5.com. Five is the numeral. Breadin5.com. People can ask us questions about the recipe. We have people in real time having a problem with their oven, and they'll get in touch with us through the website. And if we happen to be on, we'll give the answer right then.
Well, that's terrific.
We were one of the first to do that. I think that's made a big difference in developing a fan base. There are 600,000 copies of these four books out right now, but only about 10 people a night get in touch with us through the website. So my co-author, Zoe Francois, and I have no trouble continuing to personally answer those questions. We have some people helping us now with the website, but not this part. We do this ourselves because this is the way we find out about what readers want for the next book. So we put in 130 new pages, 30 new recipes. There's a recipe for crock-pot bread and a bunch of sort of Midwestern favorites. So there's Wisconsin beer cheese bread. Sauerkraut rye, which is a German specialty that's completely lost in the upper Midwest now. Nobody even knows what it is. But here's what's interesting about the Midwest. People our age and older grew up with it. And so a lot of people remember this kind of bread, even though it hasn't been around for 35 years. So when you introduce it back into their lives, there's sort of an automatic sort of resonance with that. So the sauerkraut, right, we put in pretzel buns.
You got pizza recipes, pizza dough in there too, don't you?
Pizza's always been in our books. We have an entire book of pizza. Our third book was called Artisan Pizza and flatbread in 5 minutes a day. And so the 5 minutes a day, somebody's going to say, well, I don't believe you can make it in 5 minutes a day. Here's how we calculate that. So it's active time only, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not counting the time when bread dough is rising. I'm not counting the time when the shaped loaf is sitting on your counter. I'm just saying active time only. So it takes me about, no more than 15 minutes to mix up a batch of dough that's going to make 4 1-pound loaves over the next whatever. I could use it over 2 weeks. I could bake it every day in 4 days. But 15 minutes, and every day I shape it for a minute.
You cut off a piece.
Cut off a piece. You shape it the way you want. We give you shaping instructions. You let that rest, and now we're in passive time again. You let that rest for 40 to 90 minutes, then you preheat in the oven, into the oven on a baking stone. You can use water in the bottom of the oven on a metal broiler tray. Don't use glass if you throw water in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
So the active time is about, for 4 loaves, is no more than about 20 minutes. And so that's 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes a loaf.
Mm.
If you do
One of us suggested that might have been the possibility that you take the amount of time that you mix and actually need it, and then add in the time that you leave it in the refrigerator, divide the time back, and that's how you get to 5 minutes.
Well, you got to leave out the time in the refrigerator. All the passive time gets left out. So the mixing, and we don't need it because it's a wet dough.
That's right.
We've known for a long time. There have been books in the U.S. since about 1999. A woman named Suzanne Dunaway wrote a book called No Need to Knead. So if you make the dough somewhat wet, you don't have to knead it. The gluten strands will line themselves up in that very wet solution. They just find each other because they're electrostatically attracted to each other. That's all the chemistry we're going to have.
Do you remember in the beginning, Jeff, what was the first thing? Was it a slow evolution of events? Was it Zoe that came up with the idea? Was it you went out to supper one night and said, "Hey, let's make bread"? Or where did the initial moment come from?
Well, in the 80s, my wife had given me, actually she never gave it to me, it's her copy of James Beard's Beard on Bread.
Oh.
And it's a very simple recipe in there for what he calls Cuban bread. And this was 15 years before I'd met Zoe, but we started making big batches of it. We found that we left it in the refrigerator to try to cheat. It would lose rising power over 5 days. Now, a guy named Chris Kimball, who's the editor of Cook's Magazine, had been talking in the 90s, early 90s, about high moisture dough and not needing to knead it. So this sort of reinforced what I'd read in Dunaway. And what I found was if I made the dough a little wetter than they were making it, that it would store 3 or 4 or 5 days even, which I hadn't read anywhere. Any professional baking book will tell you can't go longer than about 48 hours. And what I found was that at a certain hydration level, that it could go for a week. And then I pushed it to 2 weeks. And then I pushed it to 4 weeks. And it gets really sourdough after about 2 weeks. Between 2 and 4 weeks, a lot of people felt like that's going too far. It got a little bit dense. It got a little bit too much sourdough. One of the things we haven't talked about is that when you store dough between 1 and 14 days, it develops a natural sourdough flavor without having to maintain sourdough, which is not practical for most of our readers, or for me, frankly. I occasionally will do a natural sourdough, and then I lose interest because it's too much work.
Yeah, it is so much work. I've got a jar of it living in my refrigerator right now. I think I'm going to throw. I'm going to throw it out after this.
It's fun. I mean,
but I give it a name and everything. So.
Yeah. It's
you live
it's
with
fun
it
to do sourdough, but
yeah.
So I came to this by accident, and I got basically on the radio by accident. So radio is a medium near and dear to my heart. I'm enjoying getting on with both of you guys today. I called into a radio show after doing this for 3 or 4 years. My wife had been on Lynn Rosetto Casper's The Splendid Table. You can call in.
Oh, yes.
And the producer, after she had her little session with Lynn, said, if you know anybody else, we're always looking for people to call in and with good questions. And she said, well, maybe I'll have my husband do it. And I called in, and you can listen to this on our website of my call-in that day. But I told Lynn that I had this secret method of making artisan bread in 5 minutes a day, and I couldn't tell her what the secret was, which she thought was very amusing. I was like, it was really exciting. And she told me basically what the process is for getting a cookbook launched, and I laughed and laughed because it's a process. You've got to do a proposal. You've got to find an agent. This was in 2000, there was no such thing as self-publishing yet. We called that vanity press, and nothing ever happened with vanity press books. So I wasn't going to get an agent. I wasn't going to write a proposal, and I wasn't going to develop 100 recipes because, really, I had one basic method in my mind. For me, this whole process was an escape from science and data. It was a way to do something creative and fun instead of something based on looking at numbers and laboratories and doing it the same way every time. This was a way to be creative. So when I heard you had to write all the recipes down and develop a lot of new recipes, I said, well, this is never going to happen. My wife and I had just had we were about to have our second baby that year, and nothing happened. And then 3 years later, taking care of the second baby in a music class, I met Zoe Francois, who's a chef here in Minneapolis. So she's Culinary Institute of America trained, and she heard the story I just told you, and she said, I didn't tell you the most exciting part. So we're on the radio. I'm on the radio, and an editor called the radio station, which is Minnesota Public Radio, and said, how do I get in touch with that guy? We want to do a book. And basically, I got in touch with the editor, and it just was too much work. I never did it. I told my wife this story. She's an editor and a writer herself, and she was busy with, you know, two little girls and trying to have a consulting career a little bit on the side of her own, and so this never happened. 3 years later, I met Zoe taking care of the kid in a music class that Zoe's son was in, and I told her the story, and she said, you never did the proposal? And I said, oh, it's ridiculous. She goes, you got to do it. So she wanted me to do it. She didn't want her name on it because she was afraid that basically you store the dough for 2 weeks and you're the culinary laughing stock in the baking world. So she didn't want to be on it. And then she tasted it and she started making it. And she started varying the recipes and writing them down. Now, she's a recipe developer. This is what she was trained to do. This is what she loves to do. She's very creative. And she said, it works. And I said, well, okay, so will you do the proposal with me? And she said, maybe. So more time went by, more loaves. We shared loaves. And, you know, basically our families agreed to do the book together. We tested, we agreed to do the book. We went back to the publisher at St. Martin's Press, which is Macmillan. So it was a real publisher. We got a small advance. And within 3 weeks of Christmas of 2007, the book sold out of the 5,000 copies they had done. And they rush. We had a lot of good fortune getting national media for that first book, which I think really helped launch it.
Well, you had some professionals that were helping here, I think.
Thinking about the thousands and thousands and thousands of writers out there who are pounding away at the keyboards and looking at all those words on the page and saying, okay, how do I get an agent? How do I get published? How do I get this? You know, I'll run them off in a mimeograph machine in the basement, and then I'll hand them out in the street corners. I mean, it's just like I have been in seminars and classes, and it's just like these people are just agonized. It's like, oh.
We had some
incredible. I'll share your stories, and they'll put their hands around my neck.
Well, yeah, you know, Zoe said that. She said there are people who are trained at the Culinary Institute. They have successful New York, San Francisco restaurants, and they find it impossible to get to the next stage of a book, because in 2007, it was really the business was converging around people who had food shows on television. It was impossible to get a deal with any advance at all unless you had something like that. Now, that has changed again with self-publishing. It's become much easier because of blogs and websites to develop a following in a website and a blog. And in fact, that's how I would do it now, although I wouldn't do it now because I wouldn't have time. But so I needed a lucky break like this. But the way to do it now, if you don't have a TV show and you're not already famous, is develop a successful blog, which is, by the way, a mouthful. It's a lot of work to have a successful blog.
Mm-hmm.
And then shop around a book and then consider self-publishing it. And somebody who's got a great cookbook idea today, that's what I would tell them to do, because you're probably not going to get on the Food Network.
I've got to tell people, these are beautiful books. They're hardback books, almost like a coffee table book.
Thank you.
Some great color photographs, lots of recipes, and lots of information about different kinds of flours and glutens, and you can become a bread expert in just a few minutes reading what Jeff and Zoe have provided in these books. Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day. Now it's the new Artisan Bread in five, and also Healthy Bread in 5 minutes a day. You're talking here about whole grains, aren't you?
Yeah, in the Healthy Bread book. Okay, so the critique we got back from our – we get – 300,000 hits a month on our website. And one of the things we got when we wrote Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day was, hey, you're a doctor, and I'm looking through Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a day, and it's mostly white bread. So we ended up writing Healthy Bread in 5 minutes a day to respond to that. It's mostly whole grain bread. There are a dozen recipes that are 100% whole grain, and the rest are usually mixtures. You can make everything in the book by varying and playing with the recipes. If you wanted 100% whole grain, we could help you do that through the website. But there are 12 of them in there. 12 of the doughs are completely whole grain in the first place. You've got to use Vital Wheat Gluten in that to make it storable. Healthy Bread in 5 minutes a Day was the first of the books that we had a gluten-free chapter, and all of our books since have had a gluten-free chapter.
Is it possible to make gluten bread that doesn't taste like cardboard?
Gluten-free bread, you mean, right?
Yeah, gluten-free bread.
Yeah, gluten-free bread. Yes, there are recipes on our website if you want to try some, but they're in the books too. They're not in Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a Day. So of our books, that's the only one that doesn't have it.
Okay.
And we're working on more gluten-free recipes. Now, the secret to gluten-free and being able to store it, by the way, is you have to use a mixture of flours. We use rice flour, sorghum, tapioca, corn. I think we're really, really, we've been very successful in getting those to the point where we're actually proud of them. If I were gluten-free myself, I'd eat them exclusively. You cannot, if you're gluten-free, you can't buy the breads in the supermarket. They're terrible.
Okay, put on your doctor's hat for a minute, because we've tried that. We've got a son who is not medically required to eat gluten-free, but chooses to do so. And he's a pretty smart guy. Is gluten bad for you?
It's not bad for everybody, no. There's no evidence that it's bad for everybody. There's definitely clear evidence that it's very bad for people who have celiac disease. So that's a large number of people. That's 1% of the population. CDC is estimating something like 3 million Americans have celiac disease. And there is no question that they feel sick all the time, and they're at risk for all kinds of chronic illness if they eat gluten.
Okay.
What there's no evidence for, in my opinion, reading the literature, is that gluten is bad for everyone. There's no evidence for that. There's another 1%, though, according to the University of Chicago Celiac Center, who don't have celiac, but they have something, and it's getting named something like wheat or gluten sensitivity. It's not nearly as serious a disease as celiac disease, but they feel much better off gluten. So that's another 3 million people.
You got to wonder if it isn't bad for us all a little bit, but there are some that are simply more sensitive to the effects of gluten.
Something like that is the case. They just don't digest it normally. They may have characteristics of celiac disease, but they don't seem to have, I mean, when you biopsy them, they're normal. So they don't have celiac disease, but they have something. They don't feel good. Now, I'm going to throw out a monkey wrench into all this thinking. One of the issues in the U.S. is that we eat too much food, and one of the things we love to eat is wheat. Wheat is a big part of our diet. I'm a big wheat eater. Okay, so follow this through with me. If you have a big American-sized bagel in the morning, that's 300 calories worth of wheat. It's a big bagel. It's bigger than they were when they came over from Eastern Europe. At lunch, if you have a sandwich, a medium-sized sandwich, that could be another 250 calories. And at dinner, if you have pasta or something with bread or a soup that you're dipping bread in, that could be about 250 calories more. Now, I just rattled off 750 calories just from wheat. Oh, and then all desserts have wheat in the United States. Cookies, cake, pie, sweet rolls, they all have wheat. So you could be having 750 to 1,000 calories a day just from wheat. And for most Americans of average height, your calorie intake should be limited to 2,000 for most women, to maybe 2,500 for a big man, or up to 3,000 for a really big man. But for most smaller women, 2,000 calories is about right. You probably shouldn't have 750 calories of that as wheat. We're probably eating a little too much. So what you can find is when you're eating a lot of carbs like that, you fill up with the fermentation that goes on in your whole GI tract, and you just feel kind of full all day. And as soon as you when you tell people to go gluten-free, suddenly they don't have that anymore, and they kind of feel better because they're not overeating carbs. And so I think what really is happening when people try a gluten-free diet that isn't medically supervised, that isn't medically recommended, when they'll say, I went off all my bread and pasta and I feel better, I just feel better, it's probably real. It's probably not a disease, but they were probably just eating too much wheat before. And we weren't designed to eat quite so much carbohydrate. We were designed to eat more of a mixture. And so they don't typically replace it, because the gluten-free bread in the store is terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had some of that.
It's not very good. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with much less carbs, and so you basically have less, you know, pressure, let's mm-hmm. just say.
And your gluten-free recipes adapt for that, don't they?
Well, I mean, here's the
thing. For flavor.
We've designed gluten-free recipes, but if you replace every calorie of wheat that you are eating with an equivalent number of calories of gluten-free, I don't think you're going to feel any better. It's that I think they start thinking about their diet and they stop overeating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm talking about the people who don't have a diagnosis but are trying it. And I think it's great for people to moderate the amount of carbs they eat. It's one of the causes of obesity in the U.S. is that we're eating too much of everything, and one of them is carbs. And as soon as you start home baking stuff, you start thinking about what you put in your body. And one of the reasons I like home baking is that I control the ingredients. So personally, I tend to use organic flour if it's available to me. I don't have strong evidence that everybody should be eating only organic flour.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea of less chemicals, and so that's what I do, and that's one of the ways I control. It's partly taking control of your diet by making homemade food from scratch.
You know, I've got to ask you this question, Jeff, because we've talked a lot on the air here. Now, we have a biochemist who joins us every Monday, Don Clark out of Texas, and one of the topics we've talked about extensively is genetically modified foods.
Uh-huh.
And corn and soybeans and genetically modified wheat is uh-huh. very, very big now. Do you have any science-based knowledge or any indication that GMO wheat could be a problem in our diet?
I don't have any science basis to make a statement. So mm-hmm. personally, I eat a lot of organics which don't have GMO in the U.S. I believe by law you can't call it organic.
Well, and of course, Europe has outlawed GMO products.
That's right.
And so there's something there that
right.
it seems we ought to know about.
I mean, sometimes the U.S. Is less stringent than Europe and Canada. We see that with some of the plastics used in food that are mm-hmm. legal in the U.S. but not in Canada. The BPA, for example. But no, I don't think there's a strong science basis for rejecting GMO.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some studies that indicate a problem, or it gives a tendency toward obesity is one of the things they found in long-term studies, but that's in Europe and in Scandinavia. And we don't seem to take those things seriously on this side of the pond.
Yeah, send it to me. I'll take a look.
Well, I'll see if I can get a hold of it. Yeah, but would love your thinking on it. Because what you're doing here, Jeff, this is more than books. And it's more than a website. This is a whole re-education process, and it brings something delightful to our tables that we've lost sight of in this generation. And without your research and your work and your publication of it, who knows where this would have come from if it ever would have resurfaced. But breads are wonderful, and you will love going through Jeff and Zoe's books here. Again, it's Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a Day, Healthy Bread in 5 minutes a Day. The website is Artisan Bread in 5 with 5 spelled out, F-I-V-E, artisanbreadin5.com. And we've got a link to it on our site, brokenroadradio.com. One click, you can be there, and you too can gaze upon this marvelous picture of a Christmas stolen. And if you've never tried that, the almond paste, the almonds, and the fruits, you've got a treat in store for you. Jeff, this has been wonderful. Thanks so much for the time you've given us today, because I know you've got a busy schedule. I mean, a doctor and a baker and a publisher, and you're on the road with publicity for all the books. We're delighted you could spend some time with us.
And we didn't even have any time to talk about the George Clooney tequila that we had last Thanksgiving.
No.
That's right. And I always bring a bread to that gathering. David and I often share Thanksgiving, and that is a perfect bread opportunity.
Boy, it would be.
And tequila before.
Well, I've got my crosshairs on your caraway rye bread recipe. That's going to pop
Fantastic.
Out of our oven in just a few days. And I've got to tell you, too, my wife works among her jobs. She works in a store that's really got gourmet kitchen stuff in it. And a gentleman came in, amazingly, this week. You think this is coincidence? I don't know. But he said, I need to have a pizza peel. What's a pizza peel? And she didn't know either, but it turns out they had some there. And he said, you know, I've got this bread recipe, and you make a batch, and you put it in your refrigerator, and then you break off a piece when you want it, and you can make it in 5 minutes. But I need a pizza peel. And he has your book. He's bought your system of making breads here.
And our most successful state in the country is Minnesota. We have cold climate, and we have this heritage of people who have some inkling that the bread was once good. And you're right, it's from the German and Scandinavian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sell more books here than anywhere else. We've also been on TV in Minnesota more than anywhere else.
Okay. Well, I think this is going to be huge, and it's been just a delight talking to you. And as always, we throw it over to David for the last question because his frontal lobe begins to pulse and throb if I don't give him an outlet of some kind here.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about the email that Jim sent me, or he actually sent you, and it was about maybe 2.5-3 pages long about what we're going to talk about and what we're going to cover, and we'll talk about this and this and then some of that. And I don't think we've talked about any of that stuff.
Well, it was interesting conversation. We just went with it.
Well, that's the whole point.
And those are the best conversations. The ones that you just kind of spontaneously go from place to place to place to place. This is I'm interested in the bread as well, but I'm also interested in this kind of backing into success, or you kind of walk into the place where all of a sudden the doors open and it's unheard of. I mean, I'm one of those frustrated writers out there that are sitting around and saying, gee, an editor would call me someday and ask me for a proposal.
Yeah.
And the woods are full of charlatan agents.
That's true.
Yeah. And people out there that, I mean, there is more money being made fleecing writers than individual writers make themselves. And we're talking about the people that set themselves up as experts and sell classes and do seminars and all the rest of that stuff. But and I got your book, the first thing I did is look at the publisher, and it's a real publisher.
Yes.
I mean, it's not Jeff's Books.
That's right.
Or it's that makes the story even more incredible. One of the things that I've been looking for bread-wise is a good dark pumpernickel.
Uh-huh.
And you've got one in there. It uses instant coffee and molasses and rye bread. And I'm trying to think of something else. Isn't the original pumpernickel, dark pumpernickel bread, the old ones with the big loaf that doesn't have slice marks in it, didn't that use a specific kind of rye that made it dark, or was the color come from the molasses?
Okay, it's complicated.
Okay.
In the United States, it's very hard to find what is called pumpernickel flour, which is pumpernickel flour is a whole grain rye that's coarsely ground. It's very difficult to find. You can find it at King Arthur Flour. You can get it by mail order. But we didn't want to do anything in this book that you couldn't make by getting in the supermarket. So we did compromises. We did more of an American-style pumpernickel. So pumpernickel is a variety of rye bread. A lot of traditional pumpernickels do have burnt caramel in it, and so we don't. That's the only ingredient you left off the list. So they do get color for. They get some help now. Burnt caramel is something you generally have to mail order. You can make your own. We have recipes in the book, and you can get it off the website too. It doesn't just provide color; it provides a bitterness, which is something you have in pumpernickel. So we had to make compromises because we wanted to. We wanted people to bake. We wanted people to be able to choose their own ingredients. If they don't like GMO, you bake your own bread. You don't have to use GMO. Whatever the science says, if you want to convert right now, you can do it. So that was typically the kind of thing those are the kinds of compromises we had to make. There's one thing I want to throw out, David, and that is about when you get lucky with opportunities. The little piece we left off here is the editor who called me was a real character. This was for her. She's now passed away. Her name was Ruth Cavan. She passed away at 91, about a year and a half ago. When she called me on the phone, when she called the publisher, she was in her 80s, and she was still working. This was a second career for her that she started when she was in her 60s. She had written some cookbooks herself in the 60s. And she became a very successful mystery editor and publisher at Thomas Dunn Books, which is now part of Macmillan. That's our publisher. It's part of St. Martin's, which is part of Macmillan. And one of the things you have to do is be very, very open to any opportunity. And she was really a character. She heard this on the radio, and she was terrifically respected at Thomas Dunn Books. And she said, this is what I want to do. I want to publish this guy. And they said, whatever you want, Ruth. And so you should be open to crazy opportunities. And as you get older, keep being open to crazy opportunities. Yeah. Have a lot of respect for elders who want to do things that are a little bit off the wall, frankly. Because this was a ridiculous risk they took on us.
Right. I just read a story about a woman who was 91, and she wrote a book last year, or maybe 3-4 years ago. So she's probably 94 by now if she's still with us. But she wrote a book called "How I Got to Be 90," and she said, and she went to, and she self-published. She did it all herself. She figured out how to do it, how to avoid the vanity people, how to avoid the sleaze artists and the ripoff types. And she said, and then somebody asked her, why did you self-publish? And she said, at my age, I don't have time for a publisher to wait around and send me galley proofs on a year and a half. I got to do it now because right. I don't know how much more time that I got left.
Well, that reminds me of Harry Bernstein's book. So he first published it in 96, and he had a bestseller 3 years ago. He died at 101. Mm-hmm. He wrote The Invisible Wall. It's a terrific book, and it wasn't self-published. He's just incredibly talented, but nobody discovered it till he was 96.
Mm. Well, there's something about seniors that, and David and I are verging on seniordom, I guess you could say. We think of ourselves as two codgers on the high road to Curmudgeonville, and that's perfect. Both of us. And we're doing something very different on the radio here. But when you age, you start to get an appreciation for doing things smaller and slower.
Yes.
That value comes back to you. With the kids gone and all, you're not as pressed for time. And our task now, and this is what you're doing, I think, so magnificently and apparently so successfully, is reminding the younger generations of some of the beauties of smaller and slower. And among those beautiful things are home-baked breads.
Perfect.
Again, so we treasure the time you spent with us this morning. We've got to move along, so we'll turn you back to your family and your profession and hope you'll be around and very successful for a long time. Are you considering e-published e-books at all?
Well, it all depends. If our traditional publisher wants to continue, we'll continue. If they don't, Well, who knows? We're going to decide in the next year.
Well, the great news is this is a system. It's not just a book. You get the book, you read the book, you have questions, you contact them on the website. You can contact Jeff directly or Zoe and get an answer from a medical doctor on health questions and a chef on recipes. What a deadly combination this is. And we're going to be in the bread business here, I think, very quickly. So, Jeff, thanks very much. Be blessed. And we'll hopefully we can make touch with you again soon.
Great. Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it.